We will be starting in chapter 1, verse 27 tonight. And it is a book written by Paul in a time of trial, and it's very much an application of what we see in the book of James, him finding such joy in trials, and so the prayer was appreciated, kind of being focused in that direction. I will echo what Jake said last week. This is somewhat of an unusual position for me to be in, and so I welcome any kind of comments, I consider myself just a facilitator of discussion up here, so anything you guys want to contribute is very much welcome and wanted by me. But I look forward to the discussion, though. We left off verse 27, which wasn't the plan. I was going to do chapter 2. But really, this little section from 27 to 30 of chapter 1 is a very good lead into chapter 2. I mean, should be expected that way. That chapter division was not there in the original thing. And so we're going to start there in verse 27 and go to verse 30. We're really going to run this basically the same way that Jake did last week. We'll have somebody read each section, and then we'll discuss it after that. So, can I get somebody to read chapter 1, verses 27 through 30? And I encourage you, as this is read, to listen very attentively. This is how it would have originally been presented to them, is audibly. And so think about the way it's written and what things jump out to you as you listen to it. So somebody read that for us. Okay, Barry.
Only conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come to see you or remain absent, I will hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. In no way alarmed by your opponents, which is a sign of destruction for them, but of salvation for you, and them too, from God. For to you it has been granted for Christ's sake, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake, experiencing the same conflict which you saw in me, and now here to be in me.
Okay, before I go into what I've got to say, what jumps out at you from that? Anybody notice anything that you automatically want to comment on?
I just look how it says in verse 29, for it has been granted to you to suffer. That reminds me of like Acts 5:41, when the disciples are rejoicing because they've been counted worthy of suffering.
It's a gift, right? Yeah, I had that down. It is pretty wild that he's encouraging them to look at it like it's a gift, that they're being granted this opportunity to suffer, which is, again, this whole thing that permeates the book, that this baffling joy in what's going on with them and the suffering that they're being given. Yeah, I like that too, the use of the word granted there. It's been given you. Anything else that jumps out to you? The section starts off with this: only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ. This only let your manner of life. I'm not a Greek scholar in any way, but I found it interesting that the word he uses here is different from what he would normally use for that. When he normally says your manner of life or the way you conduct yourselves in other letters, he doesn't use this word. In fact, this word's only used twice, and they're both in this book.
Citizenship?
Yes, this word is indicative of citizenship more than just a normal manner of life. This had to do with how they conducted themselves in relation to the government, how they conducted as a citizen of a society. And when you think about the fact that Philippi would have been a predominantly Roman, it was a Roman colony, so these people would have been citizens of Rome. And although it's a nuance, it's interesting to me, I don't feel like English has the nuance that Greek must have had, because there's all these words that obviously had different connotations and things. This would have conjured up other thoughts. They would have got what he was saying, but it would have conjured up other thoughts. And what those were, I can't exactly say, but you can think about, you know, how they would have been proud of their citizenship, how they handled themselves in that way. Maybe conjured thoughts of now, you know, they're citizens of another kingdom as well. This idea of subjecting themselves to a higher authority is indicated by that word.
Because Philippi was a Roman colony, as opposed to a lot of the other cities around the area, they had a lot of, perks as part of that. And these people in this culture really did take a lot of pride in the fact that they were Roman citizens. This is a Roman colony, and I mean, that's one of the things they really so I think the nuance is intended by Paul to, because you know the word citizenship would have immediately conjured up all of those thoughts to those people. Mm-hmm. For him to say, yeah, you are Roman citizens, that is true, but you have another citizenship that's even more important to need to walk with.
Yeah, and I feel like coming from Paul, who was a Jew, that has another aspect to it. What's that?
And a citizen,
yeah. It means something to him coming from him as well. It makes it significant in my mind. This is a very specific way to say this. Barry?
And the connotation here is to be a citizen that's worthy of Christ, not just, you know, a Roman citizen, that's a great thing, but a Roman citizen that's worthy of Christ. So there's that dual citizenship, but it puts a little different twist on it, too. It's mm-hmm. not just a citizen, but a citizen that's worthy.
And the fact that there's something more than just being a Roman citizen, maybe, is it's not a, you know, they maybe would have been so proud of that, like it's a ticket to so many things, but this is saying, no, there's a little more to, you know, make it worthy of what you're working toward. He says, so that whether I come and see you or I'm absent, I may hear that you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side. This is where we get really the thematic thrust of the letter, is this side by side, standing as one unity idea. It's joyous, yes, and we talk about the joy in the book a lot, and that is a theme that runs throughout. But really, everything in the book is held together by this idea of unity and thinking as a unit and loving the same thing, having one mind and one love and one spirit there. So that's where this is introduced, really, verbally. It's been there the whole time. But he says to be one mind, striving side by side, not frightened in anything by your opponents. Now, this next phrase I want to talk about a little bit. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. Any thoughts on that? How is that a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of the Christian's salvation from God?
By not being alarmed that the things that they would accuse them of or, you know, persecute them with, by not being alarmed by those things, that's the opposite effect of doing those things. You want them, their whole purpose is to intimidate.
Yeah, to get a reaction.
To feel afraid and to scare you. And if that doesn't happen, then that just kind of defeats what they're doing.
Yeah, and they may not automatically fess up to that, right? It may be, one thing I read talked about, it may be this sign to them, whether they admit it or not, whether they realize it or not. But it makes me think of how, even in modern day settings, you hear of stories where people will approach a Christian with simply the impression of something is different about you. You know what I mean? And that's can be the beginning of something. So there's some kind of unspoken impression that I think he's insinuating and referring to here. And it's encouraging, and I think he's trying so much to encourage them throughout this letter, and I think that's a big encouragement there, to say what you're doing, whether spoken or not, is working. It's a sign that if they open their hearts and minds, you're doing the right thing. So yeah, any thoughts on that? Any other? Okay. Real encouraging to them, and I think to us. Then he talks about this suffering being granted. But then he finishes up this section, I think, with another way trying to encourage them, saying that you're engaged in the same suffering that you saw me engaged in, and that I am now still engaged in. This idea that I think, maybe I'm sticking this in there, but I don't think it's too much. They probably would have looked up to Paul, this idea, Paul is this authority, and to know that he had gone through the suffering, that he's still going through this suffering, and that they're not without him in it, I think is a way of him encouraging them in the process. Any other thoughts on that section?
Something is connected with that God granting them to suffer for the sake of Christ. It stuck with me. I was reading in Eusebius, who was a historian throughout the church history in about the 4th century, when he would write about the martyrs, he didn't come at it from the point of view like they suffered for the cause of Christ. He said they gained their fulfillment. And consistently, that's how he referred to people who would die, either they would burn alive or, you know, mm-hmm. they gained their fulfillment.
It's pretty baffling to me that And that's almost one of those mindsets that I sometimes ask myself, like, could I ever really have that mindset? I've thought at times maybe if you were to take the approach, like, if I talk about it enough or if I write it enough, maybe it will seep its way into what I'm really thinking. Because it is such a baffling mindset to me to think this is a blessing. Like I said in James, he says, count it all a blessing when you're put under various trials. Count it all joy. And it's a wild thought process, but the more you read this book, I've been reading this book multiple times a day for the past couple weeks, and the more you read this, it permeates Paul's thought process, and it's so backwards. And one of the most fascinating things about Christianity to me is its backwardness, and kind of what Jake was talking about the other day. And it's both encouraging and fascinating, and it encourages me because I know now it's something that I can think about for the rest of my life and never run out of things to think about. But very much backwards. That's fascinating. I didn't know that. But it is really neat. Any other thoughts before we move on? Okay, let me get somebody to read 2, 1 through 11. And again, listen closely. Preliminary things for that section. Anything jump out to you? It can be anything, even a phrase or just the wording of something seem interesting to you?
Let pride get the best of you.
Yeah. It says, in humility, consider others more significant than yourselves. That to me is a very powerful point in this section, and it's something. I don't know. I think we all have certain passages that fascinate us more depending on our personality, but that's one that tends to really get me every time, is this idea, do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. And then verse 4, look not only to your own interests, but also the interests of others. It's pretty wild. Like Romans 12, verse 16 says, live in harmony with one another, do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly, never be wise in your own sight. And it's kind of very much the same thought process. Now, verse 4 can kind of eliminate some extreme views on this. It's not, he says, look also to the interest of others. It's not completely to abandon your own interests, but it's this interesting reversal of priority. They're both present, but one comes before the other. And again, it's backwards. It's not what we would think. And I mean, even most Christians, it's not automatically what we think. We think, okay, I'll get these things done, and then I can look to others. But it's very much the other way with Paul, and very much a lifelong pursuit getting there, I think. Any other thoughts that stick out to you? Any other phrases?
I think this is a pretty popular text here, Philippians 2, about being humble. Mm-hmm. The humble Christ, and I think often we make some great applications of it, but when we put it back in context, I think it has even more meaning to it, because he starts chapter 2 with therefore. Why have this mindset that we're considerate of one another?
Mm-hmm.
Why try to be like-minded? It's to help each other. Based on what he just said, that we're going to be going through suffering.
Yeah.
And so you can help each other by looking out for one another, by being humble, by being unified. Mm-hmm. And I think when you put it in that context, it's even stronger, has a stronger application.
Yeah, and that unity can't come about with any kind of selfishness or conceit in there. It's got to be complete humility in the process.
And kind of building on that, even the unity that he's calling for here, which really is the heart of this, is being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord with one mind, is kind of the explanation of what it means to walk worthy of the gospel of Christ. I mean, it's part of that same thought. That's where it all began. There are trials that are going to come up. And because you have all of these things, this encouragement in Christ, and comfort from the love and participation in the Spirit, what you do is you act like a group of people who loves one another.
Yeah.
And the question is, well, how do you do that? I mean, you look around, there are all these churches where there's all this bickering, all this fighting, and why can't people get along as Christians the way they're supposed to? And ultimately, the answer is because they're not doing this. They're not looking out for others' interests. They're looking out for their own. They're not acting without rivalry and conceit. They're not acting in humility. And ultimately, they're not acting like Jesus acted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty strong indictment if we fall into that trap of not being the kind of Christian we should be in relation with one another. The bottom line is always we're not acting like Jesus.
Yeah. Which here, the defining characteristic that's pointed out is selflessness and this idea of humility. It's been there already. Back in chapter 1, you have the people who are preaching the gospel out of selfishness, and how there's these warnings against doing things out of selfish gain, things like that. Everything is about selflessness. Very vivid description of Jesus and his humility, of taking the form of man. It's an interesting description to me just because it, at least in my mind, brings up maybe some questions about the whole process of Jesus becoming man and then going back to heaven and all those things we don't really need to discuss now, but it's just really interesting to me. And you have all this about him, not counting equality with God a thing to be grasped, and which I, apparently that's more like a thing to be used is more the connotation there. He didn't see it as a thing to be used to grasp, which I found interesting because I've always not really understood that completely. But apparently it would insinuate not that he grasped being God, but that he didn't see being God as a thing to use to grasp. And so phrased differently than how we would apparently, but that's interesting. It's the point that, the whole could have called 10,000 angels idea didn't use that power for himself, but really relinquished it. Going on through there, noticed the end of the section. He says, at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. That's not the only time we see this, to the glory of God the Father, in the book. It's a running theme. Yeah.
This certainly isn't happening now. Is this going to happen at the judgment, or when?
I don't know. And it's, you ask yourself, like, is it, is it going, I don't know. What did he intend with that?
Yeah. It's certainly not happening now.
Oh, I know. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately.
To me, it's like the ultimate triumph of Jesus, because you've got, he's kind of telling this overarching story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He is not Lord, in the end, they will confess. Every tongue will confess.
Yeah, and I think that's it, looking to the end is what he's doing. And really, that's so much of what he's doing through with all this discussion of joy and suffering. And you get very much the same thing in James. It's all out of looking to the end. You can't find that joy without seeing the end result. It's just not possible.
Why would you humble yourself like he would unless you get the same...
Exactly, which he goes on to talk about in chapter 3, which we'll get to next week. Very much looking toward the end. This is, I don't know if it's a direct quote, but it's very much similar to what Isaiah 45, where he says, every knee shall bow and then confess with their tongue, which is interesting to me. I don't know how many of these Philippians would have noticed that, being Gentiles, but it is an interesting concept that Jesus, at least it appears there, is being equated with what God said in Isaiah. And so it's like he's not only brought so high, he's brought as high as it gets. He's equated with what God has said about himself, that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. He is equal with God. We know that, but this is just an interesting pseudo-literary way to say it at the end of the section there. Like I said, take note of to the glory of God the Father at the end there. Very much a theme throughout the whole thing. We had it in chapter 1, we talked about last week. In verse 10, or verse 11, he finishes that section with, to the glory and praise of God. And then he talks about, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Am I here or am I there? Either way, it's to the glory of God. Very much another theme through the whole book that is very impressive. You think about, I've met people who, they don't say thank you, or they always say, to God be the glory in every case. And you take that as you will, but it's impressive either way. And it's impressive to think of that on every occasion. This is my motivation. This is where it goes. And this is very much Paul's mindset in this letter, and it is impressive to me. Any other thoughts? This is Brian said, this is a very commonly read section. So we've heard it a lot. But any other thoughts? Just because it's commonly read doesn't mean it's not impressive. Which is just what Nathan was talking about, supporting the idea of it's always about being like Jesus. And he, again, was a perfect example of this oneness concept. Anything else?
I'm just going to say that there is a close parallel between the section about Jesus here in Philippians 2 and the description in Revelation 5 of the Lamb that was standing as though it had been slain and opening the seals and everything.
Oh, okay.
And that section ends with almost the exact same phrasing. Everyone on heaven, in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, praising Jesus for what he had done there as well. It's looking at the same thing, but looking at it from two completely different angles. Here we get kind of the earthly perspective of Jesus leaving heaven and coming down to earth and being like a person, and that results ultimately in Jesus being praised. And there it's the heavenly perspective. No one could open the seal. We found someone who could. It's the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And then you see him standing like a lion and then slain. And then ultimately all of heaven everywhere praising him there as well. So it's kind of the two perspectives on the same thing.
Yeah. Both just as impressive in imagery there. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next section. We're just going to do the next two verses. Somebody read 12 and 13. Go ahead.
So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure.
Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Somebody tell me what that means. Yeah, it's extreme humility, isn't it? It's this very vivid term, very vivid words. Now, I get the impression they would have been a little more commonly used by them than they are by us, but still very vivid, very humble. What about the part, work out your salvation? What's that mean?
I think it's related to what Paul says later on, in that even all that he's done, he's suffered, he doesn't feel he's held grasped not there already. He forgets the things that are behind. He's working forward, you know, looking forward to the prize.
Yeah, and we don't get an impression anywhere that it's an easy ride. It's always this idea of work. This is very much on an individual level. Like, there's a lot in this book that's to it's a, like we said about unity and to the Philippians as a whole. I think this is very much an individual statement. Work out your own salvation. And that's an intimidating thought, I think, at first, but I think is maybe why he comes around in verse 13. Yeah, and says... Yeah.
But, you know, you have to humble yourself, put yourself down low so you can let God in to work in you. And
yeah.
You have to have that humility. If you don't have the humility, God can't help you.
Yeah.
And there's another aspect of, you know, work in this sense to me also is thinking. You know, you've got to think through what you're doing every day. That becomes part of the work. You've got to use your mind. And purpose, you know, that you're going to follow Christ, that you're going to do the things that he did in the same way that he did, but do that and don't get proud with it, mm-hmm. what I'm doing, that's where the fear and trembling comes in, where you're very humble about it and you're very, very meek about what you're doing, although you're doing it very purposefully.
Yeah, it's really an awesome balance between what you're saying and the work aspect of it with him saying, God is the one working with you to do this. Again, this encouragement. This letter is all about encouragement, and I hope it's encouraging when we read it now. It is to me. He says it's God that works in you. Continue to work. You know, it's work, but don't let it get you down, because it's work that you have help. It's work that you're not doing by yourself. Were you going to say something, Justin?
You can't go to heaven on somebody else's shirt tails.
This is true. This is true. We kind of all go on Jesus' shirt tails, but we very true. You have to work.
Yeah. For that reason, I think this is a very important passage for children like raised in the church, like not just so they come to have their own appreciation, but so they recognize how important it is and the real significance of it. Because I think a lot of times it's easy to take it for granted when it's just the way you've been raised in.
Yeah. Yeah, which wouldn't even really have been the application with the Philippians, but it's powerful for us. Were you going to say something? Did you know? And then he finishes with to will and to work for his good pleasure. We don't have to get too much into that, but I think it's interesting that he includes both of those and makes sure it includes both of those. It's a work and it's a will. It's a dual level thing. You're doing what you have to, but you want it. It's in your will to do it. Moving on. We need to move a little faster. Somebody read 14 through 18.
Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will approve yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as light in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain, nor toil in vain. But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me.
I think it's interesting that the idea of doing everything without grumbling or questioning would factor into us being blameless. Somebody comment on that. What does that have to do with us being blameless? Why might those be connected?
Well, if we question what we're doing, we're kind of blaming God for having to do it. So if we do it without questioning, we're not blaming, therefore we should be blamed.
Okay. I'm not necessarily saying I have a real concrete answer to this. It struck me when I was reading it. Why are these connected in the text here? Yeah.
It annoys you much more.
Yeah.
And also, if you go back to the Old Testament, the children of Israel, when they grumbled and complained, God blamed them for that. That became a sin to them. So if we don't do that, if we don't question, we don't grumble, then we can be blameless.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And if you finish the thought, he goes on to contrast you being blameless and being without blemish to the crooked
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems that there's some contrast set up there between how you're supposed to live and the way the rest of the world lives. And one part of that is doing things without grumbling and questioning, which I think then by implication implies, the rest of the world does do things questioning and grumbling. If that's how you live your life, are you really different from the rest of the world?
Exactly. And it's a striking difference, isn't it, that people will see in our acceptance of what comes. What are you going to say?
As a botanist, verse 16 is of importance to me. Holding fast. Now, there's a species of red seaweed that has a root system called a hold fast, and that cements itself to the rock. And that's what we do. We cement ourselves to Jesus.
I think someone talked about that in a chapel talk when our theme at FC was hold to the rock or anchored to the rock.
Fast.
Yeah. It's amazing the imagery put in nature, clearly on purpose sometimes. But yeah, just I kind of wanted to think about that for a minute, this idea of not grumbling and how that connects to us being blameless. It makes me think of as a kid having chores to do, and I would do them, but my mom would still get upset with me. And I'm like, what? I'm doing it. She's like, but you're complaining the whole time you're doing it. And so somehow that made it bad still. And I think it's the same general purpose here, principle here, where it's that's very much a part of doing what is right and doing what we have to, is going back to this will and to work. It's a will to do it. It's not a grumbling process. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, grumbling and complaining come from a lack of faith. That's when we would grumble. That's when the Israelites wanted to go back to Egypt because they didn't have faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we become blameless and innocent except by having faith? So if you don't have that faith, you grumble and complain, you're showing you don't have faith.
Yeah. You're
not proving yourself to be blameless.
Yeah. Good point. Okay, we may need to move on again. Before we know the drink offering image, he uses it again in 2 Timothy, except in 2 Timothy it's already I'm being poured out. So here he clearly, it's always this idea of optimism and hope in this book. Here it's even if, because it may not happen. But in 2 Timothy he knows the end is nigh, and so he's using already I'm being poured out. Okay, just pointing that out. Somebody read 19 through 24.
They all seek their own interest, not those of Christ Jesus. But you know of his proven worth, that he served with me in the furtherance of the gospel, like a child serving his father. Therefore, I hope to send him immediately, as soon as I see how things go with me. And I trust in the Lord that I myself also will be coming shortly.
Really cool description of Timothy here, I feel like. That one of those things where you just think, how cool would it be to have Paul say something like that of you, to talk so highly of you. The Philippians would have known Timothy. They would have met him on the first trip through, and at least one, probably two trips back Timothy would have made for Paul. And just very, talking very highly of Timothy here, of how he would serve him. These trips would not have been easy back and forth between these places. These would have been very long trips. I read somewhere that depending on where Paul was, this could be as much as like a 2-month journey, you know, on the way there. And that's not easy at all. So this very high speaking of Timothy, I think it's interesting in 21, he says they all seek their own interests and not those of Jesus Christ. It's the same thing he's been saying this whole time not to do. And here's Timothy being a living example that they know personally, not seeking his own things, but seeking the things of Christ.
Mm-hmm. And say, bring me these things before I die, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we don't have the full story in the Bible, but from the extra-biblical history that we do have, it seems that Paul is set free from the imprisonment that he's in here in Philippians and Galatians and Colossians and other, or Ephesians and Colossians and other books as well. And he does go do more preaching, and then is later rearrested, re-imprisoned, and it's in that second imprisonment that he writes 1 Timothy and Titus probably, and he tells him at that point. So it does seem that he is set free. I guess to go back to chapter 1, and which way is it going to be for him, and here where I may be poured out as a drink offering, I'm going to wait and see how it goes, and then I'll send Timothy. It does seem most likely that he is set free after this imprisonment.
Yeah. And he had confidence. I mean, he clearly does in the book that that would happen. And we know that since he was released, we at least know how he spent his time in between. You know, he's released, he's committed to working if he's here. If not, he goes on to be with Christ. So it's encouraging. Okay, we have just a little bit of time. Somebody read 25 through 30. Okay, for the most part, this is a pretty straightforward paragraph. It's still an encouraging one, but not as maybe deep and convoluted.
The word messenger actually means apostle. There were apostles of Jesus and apostles of the church.
Yeah, kind of apostle with a big A and apostle with a little A. Epaphroditus was
simply means messenger.
Yeah, he was a little A apostle. Some places, I guess you'll read that they're the approach that Paul is somewhat having to explain himself for sending Epaphroditus, like as if they didn't expect Epaphroditus so soon, and he's saying, here's why I sent him. I don't really see that as a necessary conclusion. It seems like he's just saying, I'm sending him. You know, he was worried about you. But just to give you a heads up, if you're reading, you'll run into that view where he's almost having to give excuses and explain himself. Again, maybe we can talk about that at some other point, but we're running out of time. I just want to say at the very end, verse 28, he says, he's doing this so that I may be less anxious, which was interesting to me because it's like he's been talking this whole time about how joyous he is, and yet somehow he's anxious at the same time. And it further shows what kind of joy he's having, I think. It's not, I've heard people talk about this, but I don't think I've always grasped it. It's not happiness, it's joy. And whereas he can be anxious and he can be nervous or he can be even sad maybe, he has this constant overarching joy that goes throughout all of it. And it is so immensely encouraging, somewhat daunting, but it's something to work toward. Any last thoughts before we're done? Yeah, he's in prison. I mean, he's not denying that he's sad about that. So, yeah. Okay, nothing else? Thank you so much. Continue reading Philippians. You can read it multiple times. Jake will be doing chapter 3 next week.